You're listening to episode 2 of the Book Thingo podcast, recorded on November 3, 2012, at ShawnRecon in Sydney. Book Thingo would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians on the land on which this episode was recorded, the Darug people. We also acknowledge the contributions of Aboriginal Australians to our shared literary heritage. This episode follows on from my chat with Sarah Wendell and Kate Cuthbert. Coming up, we talk about Georgette Hare's books, heroines who shoot heroes, whether or not blogging or editing has changed the way we read books, tentacle porn, the blurry line between shapeshifter sexy times and bestiality, how much porn informs erotic romance, 50 Shades of Grey, and books by Laurel K. Hamilton, Lisa Valdez, Elizabeth Amber, J.R. Ward, Anne Somerville, Joey W. Hill, and Laura Kinsale. A word of warning. There are a lot of dirty words in this episode, and much laughter.
Welcome to the Book Thingo podcast, talking about books we love, especially romance. Kill a fairy fast on the Book Thingo podcast.
Welcome to the second episode of the Book Thingo podcast. I'm Kat Mayo from Book Thingo, an Aussie blog for romance readers. You can find me, along with my six fabulous co-bloggers, at bookthingo.com.au. This episode is part two of my conversation with Sarah Wendell and Kate Cuthbert at ShawnRecon a few years ago. Sarah runs the Smart Bitches Trashy Books blog and also has a podcast called Dear Bitches Smart Authors, which if you don't already subscribe to it, then you really, really should. She's also the author of two books, Beyond Heaving Bosoms, The Smart Bitch's Guide to Romance Novels, and Everything I Know About Love I Learned from Romance Novels. Kate is managing editor for Escape Publishing, the digital imprint of Harlequin Australia. This chat takes a bit of a rowdy turn. If you've spent time with Sarah or Kate, or if you've heard them speak before, I'm guessing this will come as no great surprise. You can find information on all the books we talk about in this episode by going to bookthingo.com.au/podcast and clicking on episode number 2. The audio for this podcast was produced by the fabulous Rudy Bremer.
Kate and I have already discussed in a previous set of podcasts our favourite Australian authors from a variety of subgenres, but I wanted to ask you whether there are new books out or new authors that you've discovered since like to pimp out.
Give a little push for Escape Publishing.
Feel free to publicise.
Since starting with Escape, I haven't read a book. No, that's not true. I've read one book for pleasure, and it was because Sarah Fairhall, who runs Destiny Romance, which is the Penguin imprint, found out that I'd never actually read a Georgette Hare novel.
Oh, which one did you read?
Venetia. And she shamed me. She, you know, she's a beautiful person, but oh, damn.
So I haven't read a Georgette Hare but I've got Sylvester in my to-be-read pub from a girl, from a person who brought some books along at the High Tea. Ooh, so I'm going to try that very, very soon.
If you go online, there is an abridged version of Sylvester read by Richard Armitage.
Venetia has a version read by Richard Armitage.
I want to say that Armitage read 3. He may have read 4, but I know he read Sylvester. I put it on my Kindle, the old Kindle that had the speakers, and I couldn't figure out how to hook my Kindle to my car stereo. And my car is a little loud, so I actually tucked the Kindle behind my shoulder on the seat, turned up the volume, and drove like this, listening to Richard Armitage for 2 hours, the whole way to a conference in Connecticut, because it's about a two-hour drive. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I really liked Venetia, I really did. And it has that sort of that slow world building, the slow storytelling that I've been complaining about.
Her backlist, though, is so intimidating. You just know if you love her, you're committing to like a gazillion
intimidating. As well.
I did a whole thread of, okay, which hair should you read? Because every year Sourcebooks puts them on sale. So if you've got like $9, you could buy like 3 of them. And so there's a list on my site of which hair people recommend most. Usually it's Sylvester or Venetia or Federica or
Devil's Cub.
Devil's Cub was the first hair I read, and I remember
thinking... Is that the one you had a problem with?
No, that's the Grand Sophie.
Oh, okay. The Grand Sophie
I had a problem with. The Devil's Cup started out, and I was like, this is really slow. Oh, my God. How am I going to tell everybody that I'm not loving this?
And I hate me when I say.
They're going to hate me, but this is not doing it for me. And then right about, like, a third to maybe two-thirds, like, halfway in, all of a sudden, it was like, nobody talked to me. Mm-hmm. Nobody talked to me for the next 2 hours. It was so good. Once it got going, that was, I think that might have been one of the earliest she shoots him scenes
yes.
in romance.
Okay. Because, is it Clay Pass? One of her beloved novels also has a...
Laura Scandals.
Yes, yes.
Laura Scandals is Loretta Chase.
Oh, oh no, Loretta right. Chase, sorry.
Loretta Chase also, she shoots him. And yeah. it's a really good way. As she
it's
said,
a really
in
good shot.
Yeah, she said in an interview with me, she wouldn't recommend shooting a man to get his head on straight, but it worked. If you're curious.
I can't remember the name of that Lisa Kleypas. It's the one where he owns a gambling hall.
Oh.
Where am I thinking, Lord of Scandals?
Derek Craven,
or is it The Devil in Winter? Because in The Devil in Winter, Evie's father owns a gambling hell, and the Viscount kidnaps her, but she actually wages to be kidnapped because she's being abused. And
no, but she doesn't shoot anybody in
she
that
doesn't
one.
Shoot anybody, but her husband begins to run the gambling hell.
Yes.
Derek Craven, I think, also owns a gambling hell.
Yeah.
But that's,
was he shot? I hadn't
read
that.
Suddenly You, I think.
No. It's got, you know, it's got Team Derek, Team Sebastian, and it's a very famous...
It's
been
a
I'll look it up and be like, yes, that's the one.
Somebody
you can just put it on the screen. This is the one we meant.
I'll put
and
a voiceover.
She actually knows everything. She knows all of them.
So how have you found that being a prolific reviewer and now an author of non-fiction but romance-related books and being an editor and acquiring rather than just reading what's already been edited and polished? Has that changed your experience of reading books? Has it changed your tolerance level for reading books?
No, but I have a pretty low tolerance level for things
okay.
that I don't like. What changes my ability to review, because I wrote nonfiction about the novels, and I was looking at them in different ways, and I was coming at, from both books, I was coming at the genre with a sort of a sense of appreciation and sort of, here, look, this is what the genre does. Here are some things that the genre does, and here are really good examples of how that works. So that's not going to change my reviewing, but one thing I do is I enter a different RWA America contest every year under a pseudonym. I have rules. I have rules for myself. Different contest, different chapter, different genre, and I have to write it that year. So, and I don't do the ones where you have to write a full book because I don't have that kind of time, but I'll do like a scene or you have to write a kiss or there's a, you know, a fight scene. There are some contests that are specifically geared towards a scene. So you write a scene up to so many pages and a synopsis and then you send it in to the contest. So I have to enter a different chapter, different subgenre, new material under a pseudonym every year.
Mm-hmm.
And I do this for a couple of reasons, one of which is that it reminds me that writing fiction is really, really hard. It is really hard. It is not an easy thing to do. And my nonfiction sort of brain muscles are so accustomed to, all right, boom, here we can go, we can write something. Fiction is so much more difficult that it makes me appreciate how hard it is to write a book. What an accomplishment it is when a book is good. I mean, that is serious work and talent, meaning to create a good book, especially one that gives me the full body tingle of, whoa. And it also reminds me that when a book works, it is because of an amazing number of, for lack of a better term, moving parts.
Mm-hmm.
And having an author who's in control of shaping all those moving parts is something that's really extraordinary. And it helps me adjust my understanding of what I think of as good and what I think of as not good. Because usually what I'm writing, I think of as not so good. When I go back and read it and go, whoa! So it makes me a better reviewer because I better understand what it is that goes into a good book, and it helps me appreciate when a book is extraordinary. It also helps me identify, because I'm looking at my own work, it helps me identify when things don't work and why. So that's what influences my reviewing.
Okay, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
For me, because I was a book reviewer before I took on Escape Publishing, and because of the style of reviews that I was writing very academic reviews, very mainstream literary reviews about romance fiction, and that's all I'm telling you this because it all bleeds into Escape Publishing, is I had to learn very quickly that even if a book didn't work for me, it didn't mean the book didn't work.
I was going to ask you how you reconcile what you want to read versus what you think other people might want to read that you might not necessarily appeal to you.
It's where I think, I mean, everybody has their tropes that they love. For me, it's friends becoming something more artistic. It's my absolute favorite, you know, and historical romance is and always will be the genre that I prefer over all of the others, but that's me. And sometimes you, particularly in the publications I was writing for, you sort of have to take yourself out of the equation, and that's when you break it down to here's what worked, here's what didn't work, here's what I thought. And it's taking those three pieces and putting them together. And when it comes to Escape Publishing, it's the same thing. Just because I don't, in fact, like, I don't know, I can't even come up with something that I don't like, but I don't know, undersea mermaid squid shifter books.
Can't believe you don't like them.
Doesn't mean that there is not, in fact,
squid prejudice. Yeah.
A very avid marketing.
Tentacle porn sells.
I know.
How is it that we always
I don't know.
I wrote tentacle porn.
Did you?
It's in this book. Hang on.
Yeah.
In the Choose Your Own Romance section, and I remember writing it, there's a whole section of being lots and lots of tentacles. There's the chupacabra, head of the werewolves. There's a whole, there we go, tentacle porn. I'll let you read it. I had a really good time writing it because I was like, where can I put them? They're in her nose, they're in her ears, she enjoys it.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know, it's pretty awful.
Well, I've read the novel that I mentioned it in our podcast, Triptych by Christine, has bestiality, the second book. It's an anthology, three stories, and the second book has sex with an octopus, so that definitely has tentacle porn.
We always end up talking about tentacle porn for some reason.
There you go, tentacle porn. There you go.
Standing an arm's length apart from you, the tentacles from Suzanne's shoulders and sides approach you.
There you go.
Tentacles around
you. And
your
it's
hips.
In second person, which is really intrusive.
Is that in the style of Choose Your Own Adventure?
Yes. That was the whole point. There's two Choose Your Own Adventures in the end. One is historical, and one of them is an erotic paranormal, and you end up being unable to escape the endless fuckathon. You end up having to choose. There's no end. You just keep going around and around. Like, we did this on purpose, so there's no way to escape.
Yeah.
It was our way of sending up Anita Blake, who just doesn't stop doing it with people.
Is she still writing?
Yes, and word on the street, because I stopped reading her after. This is sort of one of those things where you find a line you didn't know you had. Mm-hmm. But there's one point where she's having sex with one of the shifters, and he shifts mid-coitus, mm-hmm. and he's like, oh, I'll get off, and she's like, no, keep going, and I was like, wow, okay, you know what, there's my line, and
thank you for identifying it for me, that was very helpful.
So I stopped reading it, but I know people who have read it, and apparently in the last book, only one sex scene.
What? That's quite a disappointment, if
well,
that's
I
what
don't
you're
know, because I liked
for.
The plot, and I'm really excited that she might actually
remember.
Hop back.
They all say they like the plot.
When I first started reading those, I worked at a camp that was Sabbath observant, so it was dark. We didn't turn on any lights from Friday night to Saturday night. And I was in the office. I worked in the office. I was on a computer. I didn't have anything to do. So I would sit and I would read all day. It's the best day off ever because I couldn't do anything. And I started reading Anita Blake, and I couldn't put them down, but it got darker and darker, and we're in a pine forest, so the pines are sort of rustling together, and they sort of tap each other in a way that's really kind of creepy. And the sap, when the wind blows, the sap will fly off the ends, and you'll feel like little bits of sap hitting your face, which is really creepy. But the only light was my porch light, because I'd forgotten to leave a light on inside, and I didn't want anyone to see me pulling on a light. And I ended up like sitting over by the door with my back in the corner reading the book. So scared. Those books scared the absolute poo of me.
Well, I think she was the original kick-ass heroine, you know? That she,
Anita?
Yeah.
Oh, kick-ass and badly dressed.
Wow.
I miss how badly dressed she was. So
I haven't read her simply because I'm too intimidated by the number of books, and I
there's
really,
a stopping
you know, point. I haven't mm-hmm. even, well, that's what I'm told, but I'm really bad.
No, that plot line is still going. That's the one where they, in fact, only had sex once in the last one. So they need a Blake. And then
there's a stopping point that readers recommend. Like,
yeah.
Okay,
oh,
yes.
Like
stop
book
with
nine
this
or something.
One.
Yeah, book
yeah.
nine.
Stop with this one, then you can just be done. Just call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but that's easier said than
done. I think book
nine
is the mid-coitus shift.
Right. Do you know Nalini Singh's mm-hmm. first side-changing book? had Lucas sort of shimmering shape while they were having sex, which I thought was really interesting. I'm like, you're a bit naughty there, aren't you, Nalini? And I think that there were some readers who felt that that was slightly bestial and inappropriate. And I know some of the, is it Laura Lee, where she has wolf pack gangbusters?
The barbed penis. Laura Lee has the barbed cat penises.
Yeah. Oh, but Elizabeth Amber has the double pronged heroes.
Yes.
Who then had to give, to make his brother sleep with his wife.
To protect her.
For her own good. I love that. Oh, and by the way, take some drugs so that you'll enjoy it too. I'm like, that's really strange.
And if the wife, or if they don't have girlfriends, they can conjure creatures out of dust. They just create these mindless sex recipients.
So I wasn't going to ask this, but now that we've brought up
here,
how much of so we often talk about romance as works that are created by women writers for women readers, but how much of male porn do you think informs some of the erotic romance and erotica that we see?
That's a really good question. I'm going to go off on a bit of a non-fiction tangent, because I read this book by a woman named, I think it's Gail Ridges, last year, called Pornland. And it was a non-fiction book basically explaining how easy it is to access porn and how that's actually affected our sexuality in terms of what we expect is normal.
Is this the lady who was talking about secondary school students who were expecting that everybody would have wax genitals and stuff?
And anal sex, you know, because if you're looking at heterosexual porn, particularly those geared towards men, it's always three-hole sex, you know, and all these teenage girls are growing up, and the teenage boys as well, but she was writing from a perspective where it's in fact quite damaging for teenage girls, to expect that you will have anal sex, you will give blowjobs, you know, everything is open, and not only that, but you're expected to enjoy it, and if you're not enjoying it, then there's something wrong with you. But it's certainly true, because I'm pointing at you, and I'm about to talk about anal sex, and that's not at all.
On Twitter, we have this running thing where it's not erotic romance unless there's butt sex.
Yeah. No, it's not erotic unless there's butt.
Yeah, exactly. And that's
becoming
promise of thunder.
I found it really strange, actually. I think the first real erotic romance that I read was Sarah McCarthy?
McCarthy, yeah.
Cain's Reckoning. Right, couldn't get it in Australia. My husband was on a trip to the US. I made him go find it. He couldn't even find it. He had to go to some, like, Borders Express or something, where he eventually found this book. And I'm like, what is with the anal sex in this book? For some reason, that's the edgy thing in erotic romance.
It's not even anymore.
Well, no, because
it's
so common now.
In the when I did an interview for the Bosoms in 2009, there was an editor who said that anal was the new oral. It used to be very outrageous for the heroine to give oral, the heroine to receive oral. Now anal's that, you know, anal's pretty commonplace.
That's interesting, yeah.
There's been a Harlequin Blaze with anal in it. It was horrible.
I remember that one, actually.
Horrible.
But they did it. Did you ever read Hope Tar's Vanquished?
Mm-hmm.
That's a historical romance, and it has anal in it, and it caused an enormous stir when it came out. I think it was supposed to be 2006, 2007.
Wait, Bride of Larkspur.
I still haven't gotten over Passion.
takes a lot to get over.
Do you know what? I blame Jane of Dear Author for this
Passion thing.
Because
you should.
They talked about it so much. I can't even remember whether they liked it or not. You know, it's one of those things. Everyone's talking about it. I really need to know what it's about.
It was insane.
Well,
I read it and I'm like, what is going on?
The very last scene where she's breastfeeding her baby and he's all, I'm so turned on. And she's like, well, the baby won't mind. And
do
off
you know
goes.
What?
And
my mind is so boggled by that stage. I didn't even really notice it. Like, I kind of thought, yeah, that's weird, but it didn't stand out to me.
You guys have so many weird things. You could bring in a chicken.
And I'll tell you this, I've kept that book, and I refuse to give it away.
Because you don't want to scar anyone with it?
Not that. I fully recommend it to people.
Oh my God.
To try.
Good for you.
But I I keep it so that when I start thinking it wasn't as bad as I thought it was, I go and flick through a few pages. Same with the Elizabeth Amber book. Yeah. Whenever I think I've exaggerated this book too much and I'm misrepresenting it, I go and have a look and I'm like, yeah, it is really still exactly what I thought it was.
And the thing about the Elizabeth,
we love it in a good way.
The other thing about the Elizabeth Amber book is that all the lesbians are evil.
I know.
Evil lesbian Avengers.
I will confess.
Horrible.
I didn't read the book. I just read all the skanky bits.
But that kind of is most of the book.
Well, yes, yes. Oh, but I love that he has this protrusion that comes up and cleans up
the
after
seeker.
Him and he's done.
The seeker.
I'm like, that's a very polite hero.
There's never any wet
creature.
Spot. You know, it's got like
creature.
A little vacuum.
It's like a little dust bucket that lives under a stove.
Let me comfort you after ravaging you.
I recommended that book to Jane, a dear author, and I believe her review starts out, Sarah Wendell asked me to read this book and I wondered what I'd done to her.
But do you know, I actually know people who read the series.
And think it's awesome.
Well, they've said to me that the first one was the most sort of out there, and then the rest are kind of a little bit less so.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another good question. Sort of how many books do you give an author, for example, that's been highly recommended, or a series, before you think, you know, I don't have enough time. I have other things to do besides getting into this, you know, into this book or into the series.
I think it depends how many people tell me.
And who they are.
Yeah. Yes, that's very true.
Like, I had a lot of people tell me, you really should read 50 Shades. It's so hot. And my problem with 50 Shades is that I found it very boring and bleak and depressing. I thought it was really bleak. Not only because I didn't like the heroine, I didn't like being inside her head, but the book was so long, I felt like I was never making any progress.
Do you know, the beginning actually read to me like a somewhat bad category romance.
Yeah.
If you just took out the tripping, which I just found really strange, tripping everywhere.
And always on her knees in front of him, I was like, wow. Gee, why did you fall in love with her? Oh.
Yeah, but the setup of it had a very
category
feel.
Yeah.
And I think it's because that process of fan fiction where you have to get the reader's attention very quickly.
Yeah.
Category romance sort of has the same premise at the
limitation.
Beginning. Tell the backstory of what's going on with these people, put them together in a situation where they're not comfortable, and then that's where the story picks up. So when I was reading it, I'm like, it's actually just like, you know, secretary and her boss, ingenue and her
doctor
boss,
and
tycoon and some, you know,
tycoon
random
doctor.
Stranger. Yeah.
I read that we had a couple of Australian readers had a bet going on as to who could actually make it the furthest through the first book. And I won, because I actually made it all the way through the first book, and I couldn't put a finger on why I didn't like it so, you know, why it just rankled me. It made me really angry beyond the fact that I just didn't think it was very well written. And it wasn't until you put your blog post together about, you know, this is an insanely conservative relationship, you know, she is plugging into all of those extraordinarily traditional gender roles, you know, she's completely submissive to him, and it that just really rankled with me. And then, you know, just enough BDSM to make you think that you're a little bit edgy.
The thing that bothered me most about it was that, and this is a major rule break for as I understand it, from BDSM community, he is the one that teaches her, and he is her only source of information. And he's like, well, you know, you can Google it, because, yeah, that's really the easiest way to learn something in a hurry. He's her only source of information for a while. And even though she goes out to find other things and she tries to learn about other things, she still comes back to him as the authority. That's way too much power in his hands.
And the whole issue of consent.
I think it was a cuckoo.
And the whole issue of consent, that's just it's never really dealt with, the consent in there, but what you're actually agreeing to and understanding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's certainly come out from a lot of the authors that I know that do understand the BDSM lifestyle, that's their biggest problem, is that everybody has to consent to what is going to happen.
And has to be fully cognizant
with a full understanding. Exactly.
Yes.
Do you know Vicious's book, J.R. Ward's Black Dagger Brotherhood? Vicious's book really ticked me off because of that. I just found his treatment of his... There's like an unnamed submissive that he's with in the beginning of the book, where, you know, she kind of, when they end the session, she's in tears, and he kind of just doesn't even take care of her. And I'm like, that's not a very ethical practice for a dominant, you know, as far as I've read of what the lifestyle constitutes.
I thought that in most cases, afterward, there was sort of a decompression.
Yeah, an acknowledgement.
Like, they step out of the roles and acknowledge what's happened. It's not like, okay, thanks, I'm done, bye.
And I just, like, He's really rude.
Yeah, it's really, it's really a cruel thing to do.
And if she's bleeding and crying,
vulnerable, yeah. It does not look good for you to ignore someone who's vulnerable. That's not heroic, you dick.
Yeah, so from that point, I'm like, what is going on with this guy?
I think that's it's sort of one of the overarching issues is as romance gets hotter and hotter and hotter is because a lot of authors start bringing in BDSM elements without a really strong understanding of the actual lifestyle that goes into it and all of the factors that come into play. You know, you think you bring a whip into the bedroom and everyone's going to have fun. Maybe. You may, in fact, have a lot of fun. However, there are facets to that lifestyle that I think need to be integrated into the books.
Do you know one of the best BDSM books I've read? And I don't know much about the lifestyle, so I actually can't say whether it's accurate or not, but it was very emotional for me. Well, that was a paranormal activity.
They're coming to get us now.
Remastering Journal by Anne Somerville. And it's got a really slow build-up to the BDSM, but when it gets going, it's really kind of really brutal, humiliating BDSM, which I normally cannot even bear to read because I'm like, what, you know, like these poor people just need like a cuddle. But she goes into this, the character really enjoys it. So and it was the first time when I actually understood sort of how that would appeal to someone.
And why that works.
Even if it
works.
Yeah. And she did it so, so beautifully. I'm like, this is amazing, but I can't actually recommend it to many people because of how brutal it becomes before it gets really, really good.
The best BDSM book that I've read was Natural Law by Joey W. Hill.
I have that in print.
Like that one?
Oh my god, in print?
Yeah.
That's like $200.
Well, I really wanted to read it, but I didn't have an e-book reader at the time, so I scoured everywhere that might have it in print, and I found one shop that had it in print when it was already, they weren't printing anymore, so it must have just been like a leftover
extra
copy. And I've still got it. I only read the smutty bits.
I remember this was when a friend of mine worked for Laura's Cave, and I emailed her, and I said, and this was very early on in the days of the site, and I said, I really have not read a lot of erotic romance, and I keep running into stuff that's really, really horrifying to me that I'm not enjoying. Can you give me a sample of some things? She's like, oh, let me just hook you up. This one, and she's explaining, this is BDSM romance, and it's really, really powerful. And I remember reading it thinking, this does not appeal to me. This is not a kink that I embrace, but holy shit! Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
And the fact that it was a female dominant and a male submissive who has a very hard time accepting his submissiveness.
Because his job is not a submissive job, right?
And the twist in the middle when she figures out who he is and identifies her real life self and the thing that they're working on. The ending is complete crazy sauce. I mean, it's
straight. Yeah, ending. I'm like,
the ending is
there?
Straight up nutso crazy sauce. But that book, I remember being on the bus reading it, and I was bright red. And I was reading, do you remember the handspring visor? It was this tiny little Palm Pilot. I was reading it on that because it was the only thing I could quickly load those books onto. And I was like,
don't read over my shoulder.
Like up and against the wall in the window. Oh my god.
Joey Hill is one of these authors who I think writes beautifully, but I have to be so careful about which books of hers I pick up. Because the vampire ones in particular, I'm completely
so
wrecked.
Dark.
And I don't even,
so dark.
I didn't even read the whole book. I just, because usually with erotic romance or erotica, I read the erotic bits. I see whether they appeal to me and whether, because for me, I have a problem with the way the psychological stuff is done with erotic romance.
Yeah.
Sometimes I find it really violent, emotionally violent, and I can't read it. So with Joey Hill, I've read snippets and I'm like, I can't. I mean, it's beautifully done, but I just can't.
Yes.
I can't be invested in this story. And she had one set in Australia that I couldn't finish because it was so brutal that I'm like, I have to stop. I just, even if I wanted to know what happens, I just can't read anymore.
I think that's what one of the things really that keeps bringing me back to romance, though, is that you don't necessarily have to get it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a kink you have to subscribe to, but you just have to believe that the character subscribed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the author is talented enough, I suppose, that she can make you believe it, and that's where you get your emotional payoff.
Well, Laura Kinsale wrote Shadowheart, and it's always back to Kinsale. And I didn't realize there was such a big brouhaha over the, you know, penis scratching and the femdom and the, you know, sort of rapish hero. until I went online, because I'd enjoyed it so much, I wanted to see what others thought of it. And I'm like, wow, there's a big deal written about this book. And I'm sure part of it was the expectation of what she writes, and she sort of breaks out of that conventional type of romance. But I just loved it. I was like, okay, he's rapish, but, you know, he really had a good reason, and she got her own back. And I hated myself for it as well. I'm like, this is not acceptable in romance, but, oh, my God, I really love this book. It's that sort of, I really hated myself for liking the hero, but I just couldn't not. I really couldn't not. But same with Anna Campbell, right? I still didn't like the hero, but yeah. I really thought it was really, really brave book to write.
That's exactly it. You recognize it as a groundbreaker, you know, but you don't necessarily have to appreciate it for yourself. It's taking yourself out of the equation.
Yeah. So we might have to wrap up because it's dinner time. So maybe I'll close off and ask you what you enjoyed best about your trip to Australia, and Kate, what you're looking for, what you're looking forward to going forward with Escape Publishing.
I can only pick one thing that I liked best about Australia.
Oh.
I mean,
obvious things. Like, I got to try all these amazing food, like Lamingtons and Tim Tams and Cherry Ripes, and people bringing me food. Like, you have to try this one thing that we love.
We did offer a lot of food.
It is just, like, I need to share this with you, because, like, people are so excited to show you Australia. It's like, I could not wait to experience as much of Australia as I possibly could. I think my favorite thing, I loved the conference. I loved meeting all the different writers. I loved hearing how romance is a little bit different in Australia, that mystery and thrillers are a little bit more popular in genre fiction. But meeting Australian romance writers and how eager they are to write stories set in Australia. But I think probably my favorite thing was the sense of welcome and really eager, like, oh, you don't sound like an Australian. Where are you from? But most of all, the welcome and the concern. Because then when I'd say where I was from, they would say, are you okay? And then the next question is, what can we do to help? And I thought, well, this is a really wonderful place to be during a storm. And the fact that all of the people who were talking to me were also book people meant that I did not ever lack of something to talk to, because all of these people have that same passion of books that I do. And it's kind of comforting to know that exists anywhere in the world. The best part for me for Australia was meeting all the many different Australians, and especially Australians who come to a conference about genre fiction and are excited to talk about what they write and what they read. That was probably my favorite part. And the Tim Tams.
Well, we were very excited to have
Absolutely.
You. I can tell you that much.
I was really excited to be here.
You know, when that was announced, there was a lot of direct message tweeting going on about, oh,
really?
Should we organize something? Should we not tell people and keep it to ourselves? Or should we be generous and let other people know?
Oh, gosh.
And Kate, and I was like, Kate, you really should just come to Sydney for
that
weekend.
I know, it was the worst week ever. Because my wedding anniversary and my daughter's birthday both fall on October 31st.
Okay.
And of course, that was last week.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, we get to have dinner tonight.
That's very true. Escape Publishing, we're doing the launch on November 14th, and we've just been working so hard. And I think we're probably all going to sort of just stumble across the finishing line when we get there, but we get to launch our five titles. And I'm so excited, and particularly about one contemporary romance, because it has that long storytelling arc.
Okay.
It has lots of secondary characters. It has that whole community, friendship relationship as
is
well.
Is it set in Australia?
It is set in Australia.
Can I have a copy, please?
Yes, you can. Hold on just a second. I'm just going to go through. We have an urban fantasy that is set in sort of a gaslight city. But our romantic suspense, our contemporary romance, and our Christmas romance are all set in Australia. So only the ones that are fantasy are not Australia set. So lots of Australian romance coming. Achoo. Awesome.
Well, thank you, Sarah, and
thank you, Kate, for
joining me in the podcast. And we're looking forward to reading about the new titles from Escape Publishing. And also, are you planning to release five a month, or is that
we're
just
doing
the
five for the launch, six in December, seven in January,
oh, okay.
And we haven't quite finalized our February titles yet.
Okay.
So,
well, looking forward to the subsequent titles. And Sarah, as always,
thank you.
Looking forward to more on your blog, more snarkiness and more reviews.
Thank you.
And seeing you in Fremantle next year.
Yes, I will be back next year. I will be back for more.
With Julie Quinn, it's like all my birthdays came at once.
And she's fun at a conference. She's very fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, you should go to Australia. Just get on the plane. Just go.
That wraps up my interview with Sarah Wendell and Kate Cuthbert. You can find the show notes at bookthingo.com.au/podcast and click on episode number 2. The notes will include links to all the books and authors we mentioned today. A huge thank you to our audio producer, Rudy Bremer. Not only does she turn my slapdash recordings into something less slapdash-like, she is the maker of awesome shoes and an all-around fabulous fellow romance reader. Our next episode features the author of one of the most beloved Regency romance families. I'm talking about the Bridgertons, and yes, that means I had the pleasure of chatting with Julia Quinn when she was in Australia for the Romance Writers of Australia conference a few years ago. You can find that episode on bookthingo.com.au, iTunes and Stitcher very, very soon, and I can't wait for you to hear it.